Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. This is your host, Travis Hornsby. Today, we're going to talk about the student loan interest freeze that President Biden initiated on the first day of his presidency and has suspended student loan interest and payments for federal student loans that are owned by the Department of Education through September the 30th of 2021. So obviously, that's big news. And I want to go into the details as to what it means, why I think it kind of signals which direction the Biden administration is going to take with student loans. I also want to talk about student loan reform that President Biden might do. So we're going to get into that. It's going to be a really juicy episode. But first, I want to answer a few reader questions because I mentioned this, that you can submit questions at studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. The first one is a very unique, specific tax kind of question that someone has who's working as a 1099, I believe, contractor. So let's listen to that.
Hey, Travis, just had a quick question. I'm a traveling physical therapist. About 62% of my income is tax-free. It's a per diem stipend for living outside a certain area for my tax home. I'm sure y'all know about it. I was wondering if that would count towards my adjusted gross income if I were to go with the repay plan, which is what I'm planning to do with my $175K in student loans. I have not selected the plan yet because everything's at 0%. I'm just kind of stacking everything and waiting to make a decision. Let me know what you think. Thanks.
I had to look this one up, and you know, I want to say that I'm not a tax professional, so this is not a tax advice, right? That disclaimer. But I did look this up. Basically, you earn these per diem allowances from an employer, and you can offset that with job-related expenses. So to the extent that's the case, your employer will let you know if it's taxable income or not if they give you a 1099 for that income. If they do not give you a 1099, I would ask them to make sure that you're not supposed to receive a 1099 and just make sure whether or not you get a 1099 for that income. So the employer is supposed to give this to you if they pay you, you know, more than a certain amount. So if you do get a 1099 with that income on it from your sort of per diem kind of pay arrangement, you know, in addition to the regular income that you get, then what you can do is offset that income with job-related itemized deductions. So to deduct that, you need to have miscellaneous deductions be more than 2% of your adjusted gross income. Most likely that'll be the case for this person. And you would want to look up this form 2106. So like anything, you can solve a lot of things just by Googling. So to the extent they give you a 1099, then what's going to happen is you're going to write off some of the expenses like food and, you know, travel and various things for your job that you did. And then whatever that net profit is that gets reported through to your AGI, that's the amount that will be have to be reported to your student loan servicing company, and that's what they'll base your repay payments off of. So remember, it's just, what does the tax return show? That's why for the vast majority of people, we tell them use your tax returns to calculate what you're going to have to pay on your student loans, because that's something that's going to already take all this into account for you. And know that if you don't report income that's supposed to be income, then you can get taxed on that, you know, looking back. Like, in other words, if the IRS determines you didn't report income you should have reported, they can call you on that, which is why I think it's real important in this person's case that you talk to the employer just to make sure you've reported everything. And now we have a question from a listener who has a really unique conundrum facing her.
Hi, I appreciate the chance to leave you a message. We've been out of dental school for about 4 years, and we have about $500,000 in debt. We've got 3 kids and currently making close to $200 a year. We have an opportunity to sell our house that we've been in for 3 years. We were able to buy it at a good time in a good area. And that area, thanks to COVID and things, has just boomed. We also have about $100,000 in savings. We have some money in 401k, not a ton going there. I have a 401k with probably $25,000 in it from my previous job. We had to pay major out-of-state tuition, and that was intense. Long-term, we'd really love to buy a plot of land and build like a barn dominium or a pool house type thing on it, made out of steel, so just like much cheaper that way. So just trying to get ahead. I want to get out of debt, but I also really like our home. It's a moderate-sized home, nothing great, but I am willing to downsize and rent if that means we can get a ton of debt out of the way. It just seems like a golden opportunity right now. So appreciate any advice. Thank you.
Really interesting situation or problem to have. It's a nice problem. I hate to call it a problem because it sounds pretty awesome. It's like, do I sell my house with literally $250,000 of gains, or do I stay put? Or if, you know, should I use this for, you know, what do I do? Invest? Do I like try to time the housing market? Do I pay part of my student loans off? A lot of question marks, right? And the problem with selling your house at a really elevated valuation is if you turn around and try to buy a house or something else, that valuation is also going to be ridiculously high too. So the one thing I'll say is, you know, when you sell your house, you can exclude a really large gain from taxes, which is great. I think that probably this listener is going to be able to exclude that $250,000 gain from her income taxes, which is pretty cool because then that wouldn't affect her income-based repayment amounts. Now, if she wants to be out of debt, I don't blame her. But the problem is just because you have a lot of money doesn't mean that you have to go use it on student loans. Remember that student loans are an income tax unless it's advantageous for it not to be an income tax. So usually that means what is your income? That's what counts. So if your income is not expected to change a ton, then really you should look at that income and say, well, okay, maybe if our combined income is giving us a debt-to-income ratio that's higher than 1.5 to 1, then it's kind of a no-brainer that you would stick to the income-based option and not use that money towards your student loans. If you're at the point where you think you're going to make, what we're telling people now is your debt-to-income ratio is going to be better than 1.25 to 1, then it might be a good idea to take that money out and use it to paying down a lot of that student loan debt. I don't think that that will be a terrible thing. Now, whenever you buy or sell a house, you're going to incur a lot of transaction costs, and people kind of underestimate how bad of a problem that is. So, you know, in particular, if you think about, you know, how much you'll pay, I mean, realtors commission 5 or 6%, that's pretty large. Also transfer taxes, you'll lose a couple percent in a lot of parts of the country from that. Closing costs, closing fees, inspections, all these things add up. And so whenever you buy or sell a house, it's kind of a big deal to make sure that it's a long-term decision and something you don't do all the time or frequently or every couple of years. That's not a good thing. I mean, if I had to just guess based on this person's situation, I guess what I would probably do is if you really want to have the land, if that's something really important to you, a lot of times it's harder to get financing for those kind of things. And then maybe the price paid for something like that might be a little bit easier to handle too. Because why is housing so expensive? It's because you can get a 30-year mortgage for less than 3% and they're giving it out to virtually everybody. And nobody's getting evicted right now. So you don't have that market rebalancing effect of people who can't afford to pay get kicked out of their house, and then you have extra supply in the housing market. So it's kind of like a perfect storm. I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing. I'm just saying that's just, it is what it is, right? So I think I would look into buying some land, building a house on that land. You probably will have to put down a much bigger down payment for something like that. And if you sell your house, you'll have $350,000 in cash. You could use a lot of that towards putting down a very significant down payment on that land. And then you might be able to get a traditional mortgage or conventional mortgage on that new land. And that could be, if that's your dream to be in a place like that, I would vote for doing that versus using it on the student loan debt. But really interesting question. I imagine other people probably have similar thoughts right now looking at their housing values on Zillow. If you bought a couple years ago thinking, oh my gosh, what do I do with all this money? So good question. And now we've got a question about income-based repayment lump sum payments from employers. This one's a real interesting one.
Hi, Travis. Quick question. So in previous podcasts, you've discussed how employer benefits that are applied to your student loans under PSLF now count towards your PSLF 120 required payments. Is there any information regarding employer benefits as they apply to IBR payments for either 20 or 25 year forgiveness? Thanks.
Okay, if you look at the student aid website, it specifically says that lump sum payments are going to count towards income-driven repayment amounts towards PSLF. What that means, for those of you that aren't, you know, in the loop about this, is if you make a lump sum payment, basically it can count for as many as 12 monthly payments for income-driven repayment towards PSLF. So how would this work in practice? Let's say your employer makes a lump sum payment of 10 grand right after you certify your income for the upcoming year. And let's say that your required IBR payments are $500 a month. Well, since 10,000 is more than 500 times 12, that would cover your entire amount for your IBR for, you know, that entire length of time. And therefore, your employer would basically be covering your IDR payments for PSLF for the whole year. Pretty cool, right? Now, what if your payments for the year for IDR, what if that total required from you was 20,000 and they make a lump sum payment of 10,000 right after your IDR payment? You know, that means that they would only cover about 6 months worth of payments instead of 12 months worth of payments. Now, what happens if your employer makes that big lump sum payment like 1 or 2 months before you have to certify your IDR plan? Well, in that case, because you only have 1 or 2 months left of time until you have to certify, even if they made like a $20,000 lump sum payment, the most that the servicer could use that for in purposes of giving you credit would only be 1 or 2 months, because it's so soon before that IDR recalculation for your recertification is due. So, you know, every time they try to help with student loans, it seems like they make it even more complicated, right? I mean, this is extremely complicated in terms of when should you ask your employer to make your lump sum payment for the purposes of PSLF. The best time is right after you certify your IDR payments. But in making this rule, they made things like really difficult to think through. And it does even take me, I've done thousands of student loan plans. It takes me a little time to just think and stop and just make sure that it's being done the right way. Now, the thing is they haven't given guidance for lump sum payments for IDR plans yet. I expect that they will, especially as more people ask them about this and that they gave an employer student loan tax benefit in this latest stimulus bill from December 2020. Now employers can make tax-free contributions of up to $5,250 a year towards employee student loans. And that's going to be something that's going to be, it's going to cause this question to come up a lot more. So right now it's implied that it counts. So that's what I would tell you, is it's implied that that counts for the purposes of IDR 20 and 25 year, but I can't necessarily find it written down in plain English anywhere on the StudentAid website. So, you know, I would kind of anticipate that it counts. If you kind of think about the way they manage the income-driven repayment amounts, they're really just looking for when did you start repayment? When are you, you know, finished after the 25 years worth of payments? It's not as, you know, it's a process that doesn't require as much effort as certifying for PSLF in the first place. So that's why I think it's implied that it counts. But, you know, I would just try to make sure that that payment for the lump sum is made by the employer right after your certification date for your first monthly payment for the following year so that you can get the maximum benefit out of it. And then call your servicer, show them the guidance on the PSLF program on the website, which you can find just by Googling PSLF lump sum payments count. If you just Google that, you'll find the website studentaid.gov explanation of how it counts. And so you could use that in conversations with your servicer to try to make sure that they're, you know, appropriately pausing the payments for the months of which that will give you credit if they make a lump sum payment, and then those payments are restarting if that doesn't fully cover your 12 months worth of IDR payments. Luckily, it doesn't matter right now because all payments are suspended. So honestly, I would be asking for this money as a bonus right now since payments are suspended and people are getting credit for IDR anyway. But, you know, for after this in September, I think we'll get a lot more clarity on this. Okay, so that's all the listener questions that we're going to take for now. Again, you know, feel free to ask yours. We'll use some more questions in an upcoming podcast episode. So let's talk about this interest freeze. It's really quite a big deal. President Biden, first day in office, is basically like, all right, no payments and interest on student loans. We're going to go all the way to September 30th. I was a little surprised because this is really expensive, and it's something that is, I mean, it's basically what the Democrats wanted in the HEROES Act back in May. September 30th, 2021, people were kind of like, whoa, that's really a long time to suspend payments and interest. It's not necessarily very moderate in terms of kind of middle-of-the-road type compromise executive orders that we were thinking might happen. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing to say that's the right or wrong thing. I'm just saying we were expecting something more like April or July, and then it was extended all the way to September, which kind of was surprising to me. Makes kind of a little sense, though, if you think through everything happening. You know, Democrats unexpectedly won control of the Senate after winning both of those special elections in Georgia in January. Means that President Biden's got a little more leeway to do things without having to necessarily worry about investigations or not investigations. I mean, like, but, you know, any party in charge is always going to have control of committees, and they can pull people in front of their committees for hearings and explanations. They can kind of make a new administration's life difficult when you have the opposing party controlling at least one of the chambers in Congress, because it just means a lot more oversight and a lot more difficult time sort of doing things. So I think that Republicans are going to be careful about what they challenge. I don't think that you want to go to the mat about student loan interest and payment pauses, because that's kind of quite popular among a lot of voters, including high-income, highly educated voters. That's a group that Republicans want to improve upon a lot after the results of the election in 2020, if you think about it. I mean, think about how they lost the presidential elections. I mean, Republicans actually won seats in the House like unexpectedly. They did a lot better than expected in the House elections, and they did a lot better in the Senate elections too. I mean, we were talking about, you know, a blue wave, you know, a Democratic supermajority almost in the Senate. We were expecting maybe that even Lindsey Graham would lose South Carolina, right? That there was no way that Susan Collins would win Maine, you know, that they might lose the Montana Senate race. They might even lose Alaska. A lot of really big time things where people were thinking, okay, maybe the Democrats are going to have close to 60 seats and it's going to be super progressive policies all the way. And then voters, again, kind of did not do that. Voters did deliver two chambers controlled by Democrats back to Congress, but extremely narrowly. Okay. And so if you look at the path forward for Republicans, they can tell that, you know, the path forward for them is probably how do we keep a lot of those voters that voted for us, but get back a lot of those Republicans in the suburbs. I mean, one of the probably the ways to do that is to not make voters in the suburbs angry, and voters in the suburbs have high student loan debt. Benefit from this payment and interest freeze. So even if they are opposed to it, I don't necessarily think that we're going to see a ton of Republican opposition for this. So I do expect it's going to last, like the September 2021 interest and payment freeze. I think that that's going to continue on to that date. But I think that moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans, the group that's going to decide a lot of policy over the next few years, I think that both of those groups realize that at some point you have to restart the economy normally. And think about this, like the eviction moratorium, foreclosure moratorium. I saw a really interesting article in my local newspaper, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, where they said they have thousands of backlogged evictions that are waiting to be processed that are not being processed right now because there's the moratorium. And you might say, well, that's a good thing because the pandemic is creating this unique environment where you really shouldn't be evicting people during this time. And that, you know, it's a reasonable position. But the issue is that normally these things would be very spread out so that you wouldn't have a ton of people getting evicted all at once. You know, eventually you have to have evictions start again. Otherwise people will not, you know, some people will not make payments on their rent. You have to have that happen again. And so when that does restart, probably the way you need it to restart is in a phased process where you are evicting only the people that have had their cases pending the longest, and you kind of work your way down on a monthly basis to not create this eviction tsunami where it's more of just like a series of waves, which is not pleasant, not good thing, but it's probably better for the society to not have it all happening at once. I think that same thing, I talk about the eviction freeze because it's kind of similar with what's going on with the student loan payment and interest freeze. Eventually, people have to start making student loan payments again because the cost of canceling all student loan debt would be very high. And the thing is you're not going to be super progressive and cancel all student loan debt while not also doing other progressive things. In other words, canceling all student loan debt probably passes if Medicare for All passes, if Universal Jobs Guarantee passes, if Green New Deal passes, right? It's probably like a all or nothing kind of thing. You know, if you don't have a lot of these other policies pass because of resistance from moderates, and I don't think all student loans get forgiven or canceled because it's the most progressive wing of the party that supports that. If you look at the moderate wing of the Democratic Party, there's not support for total cancellation of student loan debt completely. There is support for, you know, up to 50,000. If you look at Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader of the Senate, right? If you look at some of the progressives in the Senate, they are talking about, like Senator Elizabeth Warren's talking about canceling 50,000 of student loan debt. But you'll notice that Senator Elizabeth Warren doesn't necessarily talk about canceling all of it that much. Senator Bernie Sanders does, but Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's very progressive, does not. And why is that? It's because that if you canceled all student loan debt instead of up to 50,000, then that benefit is going to disproportionately help high-income borrowers. And if student loan debt is basically like an income tax, then if you give, you know, an income tax to everyone, you could do that, but a lot of people would rather target it at people that are lower income, right? So you're seeing the splintering in the progressive cancel student loan debt movement where some people like the Elizabeth Warren wing want it to be carefully designed, targeted, affecting the people that have moderate balances, middle-class incomes only and below. That's what her campaign for president was supporting. And then obviously you have the Bernie Sanders position of cancel all of it, which is really a position that's really only held from the far, like, most progressive wing, you know, like the far minority basically of Democrats support this, right? The vast minority of Democrats support canceling all student loan debt. It's basically like your most progressive members in the House, Bernie Sanders, maybe a couple other progressives in the Senate, but it's not a widely held position. You know, why is President Biden saying he's not going to cancel student loan debt with the stroke of a pen? Why did he say that? Well, again, if you do that, it's definitely going to set up a legal battle, 100%. And then you'd have this massive limbo of whether or not people actually owe the debt or not. And it would be challenged to the Supreme Court. You've got a 6-3 majority of conservatively appointed judges on the Supreme Court. Presumably, almost surely, that would fail at the level of the Supreme Court. And then you have people that didn't have their debt canceled. And the people that wish their debt would be canceled, would they blame Republicans? Yeah, maybe. But then I think there would also be a lot of your get off my front porch type of boomers, right? That would be like, you know, why are you canceling this debt? I paid my kids college, right? It would just be an easy issue to be very divisive if you do it via the executive order path. Now, if Congress votes for it, well, that's something that Congress does, and it would only pass if it got widespread support. And also, you know, canceling $50,000 of student loan debt would cost, I think, close to $1 trillion, whereas canceling $10,000 for every borrower would cost about $370 billion. So we'll talk more about that, about why, you know, it is that President Biden would talk about canceling $10,000 instead of more than that. But let's talk about this industry some more. So what got left out? Privately owned FFEL loans, private loans, Department of Health loans, all these loans that got left out last time were left out this time. So that means they wanted to press the easy button. They wanted to extend this interest and payment freeze without having to think about student loans for a while. That's really what the takeaway message is from this interest freeze, is basically like President Biden saying, you know what, I don't want to think about student loans until like September of 2021, because I've got other things I want to focus on. So what are those other things going to be? Infrastructure, clean energy, maybe tax credits for 401k plans for like caregivers, middle-class income people, changing the tax code around maybe to be a little bit more focused on middle-class, rising taxes for higher income earners, corporations. That stuff's probably going to be a focus. Student loans really are not a focus. Just honestly, student loans to me on both sides of the aisle really just sort of seem like a campaign issue that they talk about and then don't do a ton about. Now, the student loan payment interest freeze is a big deal. It's a very expensive policy. It's a policy that helps a lot of people. I don't want to minimize that. But in terms of like fundamentally focusing on student loans, it doesn't make most voters top five, even for student loan borrowers. We asked people in a survey a while back, like, what are your most important issues? Student loans weren't even making the top of the list for people who owed a lot of student loan debt. So student loan debt is not a big issue electorally for how people vote. It makes sense why politicians don't tend to really prioritize it very much, right? Because politicians react to what people really care about for what causes them to vote a certain way. I think that we'll see President Biden try to do an infrastructure bill in February, which is going to have student loan forgiveness or cancellation in it. I think that what's going to happen is he's going to put it in the bill, $10,000 of cancellation for everyone, right? Because that's what he campaigned on. So I think he has to put that in the initial plan. That would cost $370 billion if you do it through Congress. If you do it through the executive order, maybe you don't have to pay for it. All this debate over how you would account for it, maybe then, like I said, it gets shot down in the legal world. But President Biden's already said he's not going to do it via executive order. It's going to be through legislation or not at all. So this, we'll see the student debt cancellation in legislation, but there are signals that they are willing to drastically pare that down to $10,000 of cancellation for only people in economic distress. We'll talk more about that later in the show. So this freeze until September, how much does it cost? So the Department of Education, I think, says it costs about $15 billion per quarter. So I think it actually costs almost double that. You know, why is that? So if you think about the debt the people have, it's about $1.4 trillion is owned by the Department of Education. About $1.3 trillion of that's direct loans. Only about $86 billion are FFEL owned by the Department of Ed. So it's mostly all direct loans at this point. It's really moving towards that over time. You know, direct loans is going to be 90% of all the student loan debt pretty soon. So if you think about 5% average interest rate, if you take that 5% average interest rate on $1.4 trillion, it's about $70 billion a year in interest. That's what it costs the Department of Ed to suspend interest on all that portfolio. About half of that is in an income-driven plan. You know, maybe about half of those direct loans in an income-driven plan would be forgiven at some point. So one issue with their estimates of the cost of this interest and payment suspension is they're really vastly underestimating how much it's costing to give credit to people paying $0 a month right now. It's a lot more expensive than they estimate. They always do this, basically. If you look at the forgiveness estimates, they're always way underestimating how much they're eventually going to have to forgive, underestimating the fact that when you have all this tax bomb happening, a lot of people are not going to be able to afford to pay that taxes in the forgiven balance. So how will you collect that? So of the 40 million borrowers with direct loans, about 10 million of those are in income-driven repayment. But I said that half of loans were on an IDR plan. So why is only a quarter of borrowers in income-driven repayment, but half of loans are on an income-driven repayment plan? That's because the average balances for people that use income-based repayment are way higher than people who just try to do like a standard 10-year plan. Without getting like too specific, let's just say, you know, according to the Federal Reserve, the average student loan payment is about $400 a month. So if you say about half of the people on income-based repayment are going to end up getting it all forgiven, and you're pausing those payments, that'd be about $24 billion a year. That's probably way too low because, you know, those average payments are getting skewed low by people that are using like a standard 10-year plan. So it's probably a lot more than that. But so it's probably like $24 billion to maybe $50 billion a year that the Department of Ed is foregoing from this payment and interest freeze, plus at least $70 billion of interest a year. So if you put it all together, you're probably looking at least $100 billion to $150 billion a year is what I think this interest-free and payment freeze is costing. But they don't have to put it down anywhere if you're doing it via executive order. You're not really having to account for it very carefully. You know, maybe $25 to $30 billion a quarter is a more accurate estimate. So in other words, the policymakers are underestimating how much this really costs. I mean, you know, right? There's no shame in talking about this. Like, if you're benefiting from this, heck yeah. Like, congrats. Like, I'm glad, right? If they lower your taxes and you didn't need it, but you're like, well, I'm not going to pay extra taxes because, like, that would be dumb. I mean, that's kind of what's going on right now because, like, a lot of our clients really need this. A lot of our clients don't, right? If you are, you know, an attending physician who is going for PSLF and your payments would have been $3,000 a month because you're some sort of specialized surgeon, we have a lot of clients like that and your payments are zero a month now instead. That's obviously very expensive to make that kind of a subsidy. It's interesting because if you really think about it, the people who really need the help are probably your lower income people who have no chance or ability to pay the debt back. People in default, people that went to a for-profit school but didn't finish, people that went to a not-for-profit school but didn't finish. Maybe they're making $20,000, $30,000 a year, maybe single parents. Not to say that you don't deserve this benefit. I mean, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that if you think about like how you would do the most good for the same amount of money, it's probably not giving it to the highest income people. But that's what's happening because student loan policy politicians don't really pay attention to it very much because it's just always the red-headed stepchild, so to speak, of the governmental policy. It always is sort of this afterthought, right? Oh, I can pause student loan payments and interest till September without thinking about it? Done, right? Because it's so complicated. It's such a weird, problematic area of policy. It's just people just don't want to touch it. In future recessions, I think that we might have future presidents just claim national emergency and recessions, especially if they're before elections, and just try to unilaterally suspend student loan payments and interest. It really makes the outlook quite uncertain. I don't think that you should have that impact your long-term plan, but I do think that this really needs to get settled at some point because, like, can the president just waive student loan interest and payments for just whatever reason they want? If so, you know, why would all presidents in the future not try to do this right before an election to benefit themselves, like we saw with President Trump? Like, that's what it was about, is I can do something unilaterally that pauses some payments for a ton of millions of voters right before an election. Why would I not do that? If September 2021 was like September 2022 and the payment and interest freeze was expiring right before midterms, then I would probably expect President Biden would just try to extend it even further beyond that election, right? Why wouldn't he? If you don't have any limitations in this power. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with this freeze as to how it will expire. I do think it happens in September because I think they want to start the payments back up again. I think that if you have a lot of people vaccinated at that point, the economy is a little bit more back to normal. I think that there's really not a lot of explanation that you could give as to why you would continue that unless you're somebody that doesn't think student loans should exist anyway because they should all be canceled. But then that's like a different discussion, right? Like that's one thing I've noticed kind of is if you look at the folks who are very like, so we're just like trying to help you save money, right? Like I don't view my position as being like an activist or like a consumer advocate or something like that. We advocate for you. But I think that like there's a lot of people that are think tank people in student loans on the conservative and progressive side that are advocating for certain policies. And I kind of like to stay out of that. Like I don't want to seem like we're trying to push one policy or the other, because my goal is to just basically help you save money no matter what happens in Washington and just try to predict things that might happen. Occasionally, we'll make a suggestion as if we think something's like a good idea or a bad idea, but that's not really what I view my job as. So people that tend to support student debt cancellation also tend to be the folks that are like, oh, we should suspend it maybe even beyond September 2021. Well, it's like, well, the real reason I think you think that way is it's more of just a progressive policy position versus, you know, you wanting to have student loan debt canceled in general, right? Conservatives are like, well, they don't want student loans canceled or forgiven, so they want payments to start as soon as possible. So that's why they want the payments to begin ASAP, not because they think it needs to happen or something from a policy standpoint. They just want the payments to begin again because they hate the idea of people getting loans forgiven in general. I think it's an interesting back and forth that you have with folks on this policy. But I do think it ends in September 2021. I don't think it goes longer than that unless the economy really falls out of bed. So let's talk about the implications about refinancing student loans in an environment like this. So if you've got 0% interest in federal student loans between now and September 2021, what does that mean for refinancing student loans? Obviously, you know that private loans should get refinanced. A lot of people have already looked at refinancing their private loans. One thing that I think is kind of surprising is even if you've checked your rates back in October, you need to check again because rates are already lower even compared to what they were in October or November. That's kind of crazy. A lot of people think, well, I got to hold on. I got to wait for, you know, several months or a year before I refinance again. That's not true. If you've refinanced 3 months ago or 6 months ago and you find a better rate, well, you can pull the trigger again. So I would suggest that you do that, especially with the new bonuses that we have on the website. In the menu, there's that refinance link, and you can check out our refinance page. And our bonuses now are like over $1,000 for cash bonuses for 4 out of our 5 lenders if you refinance a six-figure amount for most of them. That's pretty crazy. They've never been that high before. I remember when I got started, we were doing like $200 or $300 bonuses. And now our max bonus is like $1,275, which is just kind of crazy in terms of a cash bonus. So the way we've structured that is the lender gives a bonus and then we give a bonus on top of that. Our bonus is usually around $500 if you refinance a qualifying amount, and then the lender bonus is on top of ours. So that's how we're able to do those gigantic bonuses. Now, big cash bonuses is not the reason you should refinance. So like, what if you have federal loans? Who should refinance? Should you wait until September? So what's interesting about that is if you're needing to pay your loans back over a 20-year period, or if you're wanting to pay your loans back over a 20-year payment period, if your interest rates go up by 0.5% between now and September 2021, you'd save about 3 times as much on the lower interest compared with getting the subsidy of 0 until then. That's kind of interesting, because what you do when you're comparing refinancing federal loans or not, you have to compare the 0% interest to what the rate would be if you locked it in with a private lender. So in other words, if you get a 3.5% fixed for 20 years, if that's your offer, you would compare your 0 to 3.5 and deciding whether or not it's worth it, not 0 to like 6.8 or whatever you have, right? If you want to pay your loans down really fast, you should probably leave the federal loans alone. Like, if your goal is to pay it down in like 5 years, most people are risk averse. They don't love risk. So most people should wait. But what I'm saying is let's say you look at your offer and it's like 3.5 for a 20-year fixed. And at that point, you might consider using the money for other things. Like, maybe you lock in that low payment to get long-term certainty as to what your payment will be and what your interest cost will be. And then you use the money for other things like buying a practice, investing, buying a home, doing that, you know, the land purchase and build out that person was talking about from earlier in their question. Short-term interest rates tend to be a lot less volatile than long-term interest rates. So I think my personal view is that interest rates could go up a lot by September. It's hard to know that. You can't know for sure, but I think that it could. And just for fun, I actually decided to look through like the Wayback Machine, which is this thing you can use to look at websites from a historical basis. And I was able to check out one of our partners, Laurel Road's website from 2 years ago. 2 years ago, their best interest rate for refinancing a 20-year term was 5.36%, 5.36% fixed. Today, I'm seeing some dentists, because through our link and our website, you get ADA bonus in some cases, which reduces your interest rate even further. So I'm seeing some dentists get as low as 3.4 for 20 years. That's 2% lower in 2 years. So in other words, refinancing interest rates literally went down by 2% from February 2019 to February of 2021. Could interest rates go back up 2% between now and September? Sure they could. How would that happen? If they overheat the economy, do too much stimulus, demand returns too fast after vaccinations roll out, the supply of businesses providing services is a lot more constrained after the coronavirus pandemic. A lot of people might have retired or shut down their businesses because they didn't survive the recession. So if that happens, you could see inflation and they could go up by even a lot more than 2%. And so I said that if interest rates rise by 0.5% between now and September, then you could see a lot, you triple the cost if you take 20 years to pay it back. So if you're worried about interest rates going up, I think now would actually be a decent time to refinance your federal loans, just so that you know you can wait 30 days before accepting their offer too, which I would certainly do. So in other words, you could lock in a rate, wait 30 days, and then you could accept it if you know you want to pay back your student loans. And if you're the kind of person that's like, I don't mind paying it back over a long period of time as long as my interest rate's low, because I think that 3-point-something or 4-point-something is going to be really cheap debt long term because I think we might have some inflation, then that's a really logical thing to do, to give up the interest freeze right now to lock in something super low right now. I just thought I'd mention that because I think that people sometimes don't think about things from like a big picture standpoint. Like you just say, oh, I have 0% interest. Why would I refinance? Well, it's because sometimes you might be looking at the lowest interest rates in history for doing something. And you might say, well, if I'm going to take my time paying these back, then it might make sense to refinance federal loans. But again, most people tend to do like a 10-year or a 7-year or 5-year, and they pay it back really quickly. And if that's you, the benefit is a little bit less pronounced in terms of, you know, locking in the low interest rate, even if it rises a little bit. So with that said, if you do decide you think you need to do a refinancing, you know, you can check out studentloanplanner.com/refi. But that's not all I have for you today. I want to talk about student loan legislation, the potential future bills that we might see. So first off, I think that what we're going to see is there's going to be some low-hanging fruit for for-profit college forgiveness and discharges. So that was on hold with Secretary DeVos, she didn't like canceling the debt. She thought that people that went to fraudulent schools should be impacted financially instead of having it be the bill sent to the taxpayers, what her words were. So I think that you're going to start seeing people that had these loans that were in limbo as to whether or not they were going to be actually discharged to attended the Corinthian colleges, IT techs of the world. I think you're going to see a lot of those people get their debt forgiven because those were forgiveness things that have already sort of been in place that were just sort of in limbo because her administration didn't want to discharge the debt. And obviously, I think that that's going to reverse itself and people are going to get a lot of that forgiven. So what about the allowing people to pay 5% of their income instead of 10% on income-based repayment plans? I think that it's really clear now that they really only meant for that happening for undergraduate student loan debt and not graduate student loan debt. I would be, never say never, right? But I would be absolutely stunned if they had that 5% of your income plan offered to graduate students. I would be shocked. I think the best case scenario is that you have pay as you earn without a tax bomb. I think that's the best case scenario that President Biden would try to push. If you look for a historical context of how the pay as you earn plan came to be and how what happened with revised pay as you earn. So here's a little fun thing that I think that will probably be pretty interesting to you. President Biden had the authority to implement a income-driven repayment plan because of an act of Congress that had been passed prior to the sweep of the Republican election in like 2010, right? What he did in running for election in 2012 is he created the pay-as-you-earn plan, the executive order, using his existing authority. But the problem is he had to do it in a very narrow way because there was a lot of constraints around the way that he could do it without having Congress on board with it. So that's why you had pay as you earn say you have to borrow no earlier than 2007 October and have and also taken out loans after October 2011 because he gave this election speech about student loans in front of the University of Iowa's graduating class of 2012. So since he was giving the speech to that audience, he wanted to be able to tell them that they would qualify, obviously. So he literally made this student loan repayment plan so that the class of 2012 would qualify for this lower payment on their student loans. You might think that's a good idea, like from a policy perspective, but all politicians do things to try to win elections by definition, right? So that's why they picked those specific dates, because he was giving this talk in front of the graduating class of 2012. Really weird fun fact, right? They used that authority that they were supposed to use to create a 10% IDR plan to create the repay plan. So the pay was sort of like the early version of what their eventual plan was to implement. And then the repay, they made this repay plan without eliminating the old one. I think what happened is with repay, what did it do? It went from 20 years for forgiveness and to 25 for graduate school loans. And they eliminated the ability to exclude spousal income by saying you have to include spousal income with repay, right? They did that intentionally, I think, because student loans are basically an income tax. And if you think about what that means long term, for example, for Democrats, they want progressive income taxes, right? They want higher earners to pay more than middle class earners. The same thing would be true for student loan policy, if you think about it, because would you want a physician to pay the same income tax rate as a, you know, blue collar worker? Our tax code says no. And yet, you know, you can pay a lot of times a lower percentage of your income by being a high income earner, knowing these loopholes, filing taxes separately on pay than somebody who's just single using like a repay plan. So anyways, I think repay was basically like a, oops, we gave too much forgiveness options for high debt, high income people. But they left the old stuff in place. I think we might see this for the Biden administration. I think we might see a new income-based plan that allows people on undergraduate loans to pay less. But I think you'll still have repay and pay exist. It's just, it's really interesting. It's really fascinating because if you think about the student loan income-based repayment programs, I think we're just going to keep seeing it move in the direction of a tax. And if you think about income taxes, if your spouse makes 600 grand and you make 50 grand, are you going to get taxed like somebody making 50 grand? Or are you going to get taxed like a couple making 650? So if it was just you and you're making, you know, 50K, well, maybe you'd only pay like 12% taxes or something like that. But, you know, if you're making 650 as a couple, then that 50K income that you earned is going to get taxed at that top 37% rate. So I think you're going to continue to see it to become harder for people to exclude income from their spouse on their income-based repayment. But I think we'll see the existing loan programs continue to exist, probably unfortunately, because that means the loan programs are going to be really complicated for a long time. I don't think that we're ever going to see higher education be completely free, because, you know, in terms of predicting what's going to happen with student loan policy over the next several years, I think that you're more likely to see bankruptcy be more of a discussion. Because if you think about making public college free, maybe eventually it will be free for some low earners, or it'll be free community college or something like that. But think about a state like West Virginia, right? In the Senate, I know from my time reading 538, the Senate very much biases rural, wider, smaller states where maybe they would have a little bit lower share of college degree completion. Look at like a state like West Virginia. So you're the 50th Democratic senator having the control of the Senate belong to Democrats. And I think Joe Manchin's up for election in like a few years or a couple years. He's representing West Virginia, which has 18% of people having a college degree. So Joe Manchin, Senator Joe Manchin, would be the deciding vote for whether or not $10,000 of student loan debt's going to be canceled. And you're the deciding vote for this. Now the attack ads are going to be attacking you for not offering $10,000 of credit card debt cancellation or $10,000 of personal loan debt cancellation. It's a different animal, I know. That's what the attack ads would be centered on. And canceling $10,000 of student loan debt for every American when it costs $370 billion, that's not going to be something that I think would be super popular, you know, if you do that and not other things. Now, if you did it all, maybe that would be looked at great. I don't know. But why won't we see 10,000 of canceled credit card debt? Because it trades for pennies on the dollar. It's really easy to wipe out in bankruptcy. Student loans are not easy to wipe out bankruptcy. That's why people's lives, in some cases, get wrecked by them, because there's just no way to get rid of them. And then people don't understand, because of how complex they are, that their student loan debt is just merely an income tax, which is not something to get super stressed about, because it's literally just a percentage of your income. Some of it percentages needs to go into saving for the tax bomb. Some of it needs to go into the loans. But even if you have a gazillion dollars of student loan debt, it's just an income tax, which is tough. But again, people live in California instead of Texas because they're glad that they live there, right? You know, same analogy, you went and became a veterinarian or a dentist or a lawyer or a physician because presumably you enjoy doing that kind of work than what you would do without that degree. And if you don't, by the way, you can go back to school and get a different degree and do something else and literally pay nothing different on your student loans because it's still the same percentage of your income. So I don't know. I think that if I were going to predict one big change to student loans, besides maybe allowing undergrads to pay a little less and maybe having 10,000 of canceled debt happen for like a specific audience of people, maybe, just maybe, they might extend the student loan payment and interest freeze another 3 months after September. I don't know. That would be if they do extend it one more time, I think it would be a 3-month extension. I don't think it would be another really long period of time like this one was. But you know, if they did have bankruptcy happen, the big hit you might see would be like the refinanced student loan market. Because I think that private student loans that people take out like on the front end are already super high interest. It's like really, really high. There's like a couple places out there that'll refinance your student loan into a personal loan, like First Republic Bank. And they have really low interest rates, but they have super high requirements to qualify, right? So I think that high-income people wouldn't be impacted too much by interest rates for allowing student loans to be discharged in bankruptcy. But I think like middle class and lower income people would get impacted by that. So you would need to do something if you allowed bankruptcy for student loans. I mean, it wouldn't create that big of an issue, but it would probably reduce the attractiveness of refinancing for middle class people. That might not be an option anymore. In which case, honestly, you might argue that allowing bankruptcy for student loans might pay for itself in a roundabout way, because people that would have normally refinanced $40,000 to a lower interest rate would instead keep it with the government, because the banks would not want to allow someone to refinance $40,000 that might have a 680 credit score because of the chance that they would default and not pay it back. So the bank would need to charge 10% interest instead of 5% interest to make that worthwhile. Meanwhile, the bank could charge 4% on that $250,000 student loan for the dentist, because the bank knows that dentist is not going to default because they need a good credit to buy a house or buy a practice. Right. And that person's got a 760 credit score. And so they can still give that really low interest rate to that person without the bankruptcy protections for the lender. I think that that's kind of an interesting thing that we might see. Hard to predict this stuff. Right. And again, all this stuff is not me saying this should happen or this should not happen. I try to not take a big position on any of this stuff. I think that I'm just trying to predict what I think might happen. One thing that I do expect is that you will see the tax bomb forgiven at some point and eliminated. I don't know if it's going to happen in this next 4 years. If it did, I think the way it would happen is they would successfully pass some version of 10,000 of cancellation, and that they would realize that it would be taxable income, and they would put into the code something about student loan debt would not be considered taxable income, and they would do it unintentionally, and that would actually end up carrying over to the forgiveness for pay and repay. I think that's actually how you might see it happen in the next couple of years. I mean, I'd be shocked if that happened, but I think it could. You know, I think that'd be pretty awesome, right? I mean, but if they did that, you know, we'll see, right? So we're already baking that into our advice now. We're kind of telling people, well, if you have a 1.5 debt-to-income ratio, we used to say refinance if you're at that debt-to-income ratio. Now we're kind of more conservative with it. We're like saying, well, let's do 1.25 now, kind of assuming that they might do a forgiven tax bomb. And then that way you're kind of baking that into your decision of whether or not to refinance. So, because if you're more conservative with that threshold, then it also bakes in potential things happening, like them doing a student loan payment and interest freeze in like 2026 because of the great meme stock correction. I don't know, right? Whatever the next financial crisis is and whatever it's centered at, you know, and if they suspend student loan payments and interest, or the potential that they might, you might consider that. But I really don't think they're going to do it again, ever, unless you have a major, major, major crisis. I mean, think about the pandemic. Like, we're going to be talking to our kids and grandkids about this for the rest of our lives. Just how weird this was, how just strange this past year has been, just all the loss, all the pain, all the mental health challenges. I mean, it's just something that's just the most shocking event of our lives, up there with 9/11, really. I mean, in terms of just how devastating this year has been to so many people. So are you going to suspend payments and interest with every recession? I mean, it might be tempting to do that, but at the same time, I think that having student loan payments and interest be started and then suspended and started and then suspended, I mean, I think people realize that that would just be such chaos. And honestly, at that point, you'd be so much better off just canceling it all if that's what you're going to do anyway. So who knows? Maybe we'll eventually get there politically. I think that it's whatever that moderate wing of the party supports that ends up happening. And right now, that moderate wing does not support that, and you're not going to see any primary challenges over student debt cancellation. I mean, never say never, but again, I think that's very unlikely. I think that the best evidence that we have of what's going to happen with student loan debt is to look at the new Secretary of Education, Secretary Miguel Cardona. He was in an interview a couple days ago, and his quote on student debt relief was that he supports canceling $10,000 of student loan debt for all borrowers, which makes sense. You know, that's what President Biden's position is, so that's his opening bid. But he also, in that same interview, said after that, he said, quote, "We have to assess the damage that student debt is causing and make sure we're targeting the support for students who need it the most." That is a statement that is telegraphing their willingness to compromise on the $10,000 of canceled student loan debt being only for borrowers that are in deep economic distress, because Republicans don't want to cancel any debt, or at least most of them don't. That's him basically saying, we know that we're not going to get $10,000 of cancellation across the board. Will you work with us to do something that costs $20 or $30 billion instead of something that costs $370 billion? And can that $20 or $30 billion go to people that have low incomes, that are in default, that are in deep economic distress? So I think that says how they're going to approach a lot about student loans. Secretary Cardona himself is really a K-12 person. He was one of the leading voices on the Democratic side that were calling for students to go back to school because of the damage, especially to low-income students and students of color that the virtual learning policy was causing. And so the September pause, along with nominating someone like Secretary Cardona, really kind of says, well, student loans, just go away and leave us alone for a while so we don't have to think about you, so we can focus on all these other things that are just way more important to us. And I guess one positive is, you know, you had Rohit Chopra leading the CFPB now. He used to be the student loan ombudsman, so definitely a big advocate for student loan borrowers. Certainly from a regulatory perspective, you might see them go after the servicers a lot more for bad service. You might see him try to help focus on streamlining PSLF and forgiveness and that kind of thing. The system's so complicated, I do wonder how much they're going to be able to do. We saw a lot more movement on student loan policy under President Obama than President Trump, right? We had huge changes, monumental changes. A lot of those changes happened kind of all at once because Democrats had a supermajority in the Senate with 60 votes. And even if you had no filibuster, you still have to pass something with 50 plus one, with the VP, Vice President Harris, casting the deciding vote. And you're not going to be super progressive, because you can't with a narrow majority. It's just not going to happen politically, I mean, at least for the next 2 years. Maybe in 2022, maybe you do have a blue wave or something. Who knows? But then the party out of power tends to pick up seats in the election after the presidential election. So who knows what's going to happen? Just remember that they didn't axe pay as you earn when they did repay, right? And then Senator Lamar Alexander made this last-ditch effort to eliminate everything but repay when he was retiring this before this election, and he did not succeed, but he did say he would leave all the existing repayment plans in place. So those are some of the thoughts. I know that's a lot. I've got a lot on my mind, so that's why this today's episode is a little bit longer. We'll answer some more questions in a future episode, but I know this. I know that your paused student loan payments and interest will begin at some point, so it's a great time to get a plan which does not depend on short-term tactical kind of decisions by political leaders as to what they're going to do with the student loan payments and interest as much. The long-term plan is really much a multi-decade decision of which path is better, forgiveness or repayment. How can I become wealthy and invest and grow my wealth despite my student loan debt? And how can I think about that in a way that allows me to have positive financial growth with my family? That's really, I think, why we've continued to do so many plans during this almost closing in on a year of paused student loan payments and interest. I would have thought we would have been totally blown up financially as a company from this. But I think people realize, like, you have money that you weren't expecting to have. At least part of it can be invested in getting a better plan in place. And that's a wise investment because it's going to make you not have anxiety about the debt anymore. And we've been doing a lot of follow-up plans too. A lot of interesting ones, because some of the people that I advised back like 3-4 years ago are calling me back. I know you said if I ever make over $500,000 a year that I needed to call you back and we needed to have a discussion about refinancing. Well, we didn't think that was going to happen, but guess what? It did. And now I think I need to discuss whether or not I should be refinancing with a follow-up plan, or, you know, other things people have called about. Okay, I expected this you know, I didn't know this was coming, but I had this, got this huge inheritance. I got a $200,000 inheritance, and I need to know if I should use it for, towards paying my loans off, or if I should invest with it. There are a lot of really interesting kind of follow-up plans we're doing for clients too, because those are basically $100 cheaper than the initial rates is what our follow-up plans cost. And for clients only, we even have a refer a friend program now. So clients that have already hired us for a plan are able to refer their friends. And if their friends mention them as the referral source, they get basically a $100 bonus. That's kind of cool too. Doesn't apply if you're not a client yet. You need to be a client because, you know, that's just how we've structured it. But we have the refer a friend program. We've got the huge refinancing bonuses, bigger than ever. So I do expect that what's going to happen is, like, most people procrastinate. And so a lot of people will wait to get help for their student loans or a follow-up plan. They'll wait until like the first week of October. And my guess would be like, just like Valentine's Day, trying to find a place for getting food with your significant other, right? For outdoor dining in a heated little capsule, right? Those are all booked. They probably were booked like a couple weeks ago, right? So that's what I think will probably happen with us. Probably my guess is by like July or so, or August, I would imagine a lot of those October appointments are going to get full. So take advantage of the more flexibility that we have and get a plan if you need one, and also consider refinancing if you think that interest rates are headed higher at any point. You need to pull the trigger on that, because I do think that we'll be looking back. Some people will be looking back and saying, golly, I'm kicking myself for not refinancing to a 3-point whatever rate, because now it's only 4.5 or 5 or something, not nearly as attractive. So anyways, have a great week. Hopefully this has been kind of interesting, talking through some of the things that might happen now that we know a little bit more about student loan policy, what it is under President Biden. You know, just stay positive. The other day I was kind of thinking, I was just getting a little discouraged just with like, just how we're, there's still kind of no real end in sight. Like, yeah, we have the vaccine, but it's like the rollout slower than expected. And it's easy to kind of get down sometimes, especially I think when in a lot of the country, it's like a lot colder weather, the day it gets dark a lot sooner, and it's just easy to get discouraged sometimes. But I just want to say it's going to be okay. We're going to get through this. A lot of people's finances are in better shape than they've ever been. And when you finally can go on your trip or go to concerts again, you're going to do it, and it's going to feel like the best thing ever. You're going to feel like, oh my gosh, this is just so wonderful. I'm so glad that we're back to some semblance of normalcy, right? So stay positive. Have a great week. And if you have any questions, hit us up. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast.